Welcome to the More Perfect Union, the podcast that offers real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton, a writer and a social media political activist from Los Angeles, California, by way of Tulum, Mexico, which I just got back from last night.
I'm Rebecca Kuschmider, a social policy advocate and freelance writer from Kensington, Maryland, by way of my living room.
Hi, I'm DJ McGuire, a causist meter and a musician from Suffolk, Virginia, which is where my living room is.
Hi, I'm Greg Matuzak, a former political activist, a teacher, and a Cincinnati liberal from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Do they allow liberals in Cincinnati?
No. Actually, if you want to know, Cincinnati liberals, here in Cincinnati, we think we're like the most liberal thing since ever. But anywhere else in the world, you know, we're pretty conservative. Yeah, so we think we're pretty crazy and, we're not. I'm figuring that out while talking to you guys. That maybe I'm not the most liberal person in the world.
Yeah, you got to become a coastal elite like the rest of us.
So we want to start off tonight by sending out, there's so much in the news and we're going to hit it all, but we wanted to start tonight with something upbeat, happy, a first for women in this country. Tammy Duckworth, the senator from, where's she from?
Illinois.
Had a baby, and she is the first sitting senator to ever give birth to a child.
Oh, congratulations. Mazel tov, Tammy. She's, you know, this is her second child. So, she welcomes her second child. So congratulations to the whole family. I'm sure the older sibling is in a bit of a state of shock, but it's wonderful news.
That is.
I just want to see her nursing on the Senate floor in front of Chuck Grassley.
You know what? Chuck Grassley's from farm country. I don't think that would even make him blink.
Well, I'll tell you, there was something today in the news that made Donald Trump blink, and that was the FBI raid of Michael Cohen's office. And wow. About big news on a Monday afternoon.
Good times.
Good times.
Yeah, it's unclear what exactly Mueller passed along that required this sort of instantaneous raid activate moment. But, they're thinking that it has to do with the money transfer to Stormy Daniels.
It has to do with more than that, I'm guessing.
And I think Trump also knows his local history, and he knows how John Gotti seemed invulnerable until the prosecutors got Bruce Cutler off of his legal team on the theory, not necessarily wrong, that Cutler was involved in a lot of malfeasance of his own. And so therefore he could not credibly be a defense attorney and a witness at the same time. Michael Cohen is probably in the same boat, frankly. He could be a co-defendant on some things. So
didn't Mueller actually prosecute Gotti?
I don't know who was on that team.
I can't remember.
I don't rule it out, but I won't rule it in either. So
I'm going to hit up the Google machine on this. You guys carry on without me.
But
here.
Ironically, though, this investigation means is that even if Trump does fire Mueller, that won't stop the Michael Cohen investigation because that's being done by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Trump would then have to go around and fire that attorney again and try replacing him with somebody, which would cause its own huge uproar. So this is becoming, for Trump, it's becoming the legal version of whack-a-mole. Even if Mueller was involved in the
Gotti prosecution. Just saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so yeah, the Gotti analogy is more apt than DJ knew.
And by the way, let's not forget that when we say that Trump might fire Mueller, he can't fire Mueller. He has to fire Rod Rosenstein, or he has to replace Jeff Sessions, who would then replace Rod Rosenstein. So there's a lot of steps here. It could happen overnight in a tweet. I'm not ruling that out. But there are steps to this. He can't just fire Robert Mueller.
But I think there are breadcrumbs that we can follow on the how useful would firing Robert Mueller be. This week, there was a footnote in some missive that came out of Mueller's office it was out of Rosenstein's office saying that there are people involved in the investigation who have authority to continue it separate and apart from Mueller and the special counsel guidelines. So the investigation might not stop with Mueller. And then there was the fact that Mueller's office was saying that they were going to be preparing a report for Congress possibly as soon as this summer, which says that they already have things to be reporting to Congress. They're just dotting I's and crossing T's. So Trump could fire Mueller all he wants. It doesn't make the investigation itself or the findings so far of the investigation go anywhere.
Well, when you say, you know, how useful would it be? Let's remember that these are the same people who think the way to cut down on school shootings is to train teachers to carry guns. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, they're also telling teenagers to carry clear backpacks, so...
Right, right.
There you have it. So, there are some really strategic thinkers here.
Yeah, so you know, connecting the dots is not their strong suit.
So what was right before we came on air, there was another news bulletin that flashed.
Yes, this was a New York Times alert that came through that Mueller is investigating a $150,000 payment by a Ukrainian national to Trump for a video speech. It was a speaker's fee, which in and of themselves are not nefarious, but it was in 2015 leading into the campaign, and they're kind of tracking what this money was for, why a Ukrainian wanted Trump to talk to him so bad, and this is, the Times calls it part of a broader examination of streams of foreign money to Mr. Trump and his associates in the years leading up to the election. So they're really looking at who Trump knew in Russia and in Ukraine, and given who Paul Manafort knew over there, that's not an unreasonable thing to question.
Wow.
So I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to call an audible and say, you know, we're covering a lot of stuff that's going to be covered and has been covered on every news station. We're giving the facts. I'm more interested in what you guys, how you feel about it, where you think it's going. You know, today I was having a conversation with Jessica, and I said, oh, somebody on the news said this is the beginning of the end game. And she said, yeah, what does that mean, that there's another year and a half to go? So...
Jessica's not wrong.
My point is that, yeah, we can talk about the facts, but I'd rather we discuss where we think this is going. I think this is big news. This could impact how he proceeds in Syria, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. We've got a president who's supposed to be getting ready for high-level face-to-face negotiations with the leader of North Korea. And this is what he's thinking about. And you know that this is dominating his focus. You know, this is such a big story, and we're just talking about the legal kind of mundane minutia about it.
So wait, Kevin, do you think he's going to go to that summit and ask to defect?
Today, GJ, I would say no, but by the end of May?
No, this is interesting because before all this hit, one thing that we might have had a chance to talk about but probably won't was David Axelrod actually asking Democrats to damp down the impeachment talk because he was concerned, one, that it could rile up Trump voters and it could scare away some centrist voters. But the other thing he said was interesting is that he said, you know, we may not at some point we may know enough that that impeachment is the right thing to do. But he wasn't sure that we knew enough now. And if we automatically say we're definitely going to impeach him, then his concern was that impeachment would just become something that every president goes through. Now, Tom Steyer basically essentially accused him of being a complete blockhead. For those of you under 40, that means somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about. but it is interesting in terms of how the Democrats take this going forward. Because, it's not just, okay, this is a big deal and it's going to really seriously hurt Trump down the road. But the question is, how much are we going to know? How quickly do the wheels of justice grind between now and November? I don't think they necessarily grind that fast. Robert Mueller is not a fast guy. He's a methodical guy. And even if he does put a report together for the summer, it may very well be an interim report. He says, this is what I found so far. I'm going to go back and keep looking. Okay, thanks, bye. So, you know, Democrats have to be careful. This may not be the one that finally gets him. You know, this is, I would say this is not the beginning of the, I'm going to borrow a line from Winston Churchill. I don't think this is the beginning of the end, but I do think it's the end of the beginning.
I see. Now, what I would say is, you know, we have, you know, I, as gleeful as I get about bad things happening to bad people, and I think there are any number of bad people attached to the Trump administration, I also understand that the best way to stop the Trump policy agenda is through good old-fashioned partisan gridlock. So get out to vote in November, win the House, win the Senate, and stop Trump the old-fashioned way.
See, I'm gonna disagree with David Axelrod, who I actually think is a brilliant guy, and hell, he got a relatively unknown senator elected president. You can't do much better than that in the political consulting world. But I think on this issue, well, he's probably partially right. Because he's really talking to members of Congress, not getting ahead of the story, and not making that the rallying cry for their reelection or midterm success. However, I think the way to get out the vote in November is to tell the left that if you show up, young people, if you hate Trump, and if you show up, yes, you will get a Democratic Congress, and yes, they will vote articles of impeachment. And I will bet as much money as anyone wants to bet that if we have a Democratic House in 2019, someone is proposing articles of impeachment and they will get to a vote. Will it be passed? I think so, but I can guarantee you that someone is going to introduce articles of impeachment.
Oh, sure it is. They're already being introduced, so they'll be introduced again.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, there are articles of impeachment floating out in the hopper.
They're already,
now.
That's not an issue. The question is, because Republicans are actually using the impeachment threat to rally their base, to get their Trump voters out and say, look, if you don't vote, your hero is going to be gone because Democrats will get rid of him. So the question becomes how. Not even impeachment is going to encourage lots of people to vote. The question is, whom does it encourage to vote?
Right. And I think it works better for the left. I think it works better for the left. But then again, I haven't done polling on it. So,
but not only does
and why
it, not
Kevin,
only are we
you're
talking
slacking.
About voting,
do some polling.
Yeah. Not
on,
only are we talking
dude.
About voting, but we should talk about money because, you know, according to Liza Minnelli, money makes the world go round. Thank you, Kevin. I knew you'd get that one. Because
life is a cabaret, my friend.
I'm going to have that song in my head all night now.
thank you. Because in all honesty, the right is using whenever someone rallies, like, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to impeach him. There's a fundraising letter right now just because I even implied that. You know, some liberal in Cincinnati said this on his podcast. We got to save our guy. You know, they didn't even get my name spelled correctly.
I like how you brought it back to being a Cincinnati liberal, though. That was nice.
Yeah, really.
Callback.
They're like, we got to save it. And so right now they're raising money off the every time you say the word. I'm not even going to say the word. I'm going to say it in Pig Latin. Impeachment A. But they're raising money. So they can't use my sound clip. I'm telling you. And it makes us sound...
I think that's how they say it actually in Canada.
Yeah.
Impeachment A.
It makes us sound unreasonable. Like, we're not even going to listen to... Right now, we really don't have a report. All we know is what we've seen in the Washington Post, which is a fine and upstanding paper, no matter what anyone says. And that's all. I'll leave it there. But we don't have a report yet from Mueller. All we're hearing is just, you know, hearsay.
Listen, of course, you know, it's like when somebody commits a crime and you have to say they allegedly committed it. Of course we don't know what's going to be in that report. Of course it's possible that, you know, people will be charged with crimes, but it won't go to the man on top. It won't go to the president of the United States. Is it possible? Yes. I mean, we found out it was possible for Donald Trump to get elected president. But let's be realistic here. He's going to have the goods on Donald Trump. It may not be the most obvious set of facts, but there clearly has been, and still to this moment, are obstruction of justice tentacles going all through this administration. Let's not forget, everybody's talking today about Michael Cohen's office being raided. because of the Stormy Daniels payment. Let's not forget that his other attorney, John Dowd, actually floated the idea of pardons to Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn to try to buy their silence. This guy has so many avenues of obstruction to go down. Mueller is like a kid in a legal candy shop.
The legal candy shop sounds like the worst candy shop ever.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad name for a candy shop, yeah.
It's like the sanitary fish market. That doesn't sound good.
No, I think that was Greg's college band, wasn't it?
Yes.
The sanitary fish market?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, in the legal candy shop, don't try the penal bars.
Oh, God. We went there.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about this. We've had our bit of candy. Now let's eat our vegetables by talking about what else is in the news. Specifically, Syria, which had that horrific sarin attack, or gas attack. I assume it was sarin. Here's my question that I still haven't seen in all of the articles and all of the news coverage I've devoured on this thing. Why the hell did Assad do it? Who was he trying to kill with this? It seems he just hit innocent children and citizens. Who was he after?
I don't know.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. And now somebody's bombing him in retaliation and nobody knows who.
Yeah, no, yes, everybody knows who. It was the Israelis.
Well, everyone knows who. Yeah, it's obviously it's the Israelis, but nobody's taking credit for it. Right. You know, I talked to somebody I know who's pretty well-versed in Syria, and I asked, you know, what can we do? I mean, short of assassinating Assad, what would fix this? And her response was, well, I mean, Russia. We'd have to stop Russia from funding them and providing them with guns. And I asked her, you know, what is Russia getting out of this chaos? Is the oil there that valuable? And, you know, no, it's not. So I just don't know. I mean, the whole thing is kind of nonsensical, and damned if I know how to make it better. Smarter people than I have been trying for years to fix this problem, and nobody's got any good answers. Maybe DJ has good answers. DJ, can you fix Syria in 20 seconds or less?
Yes.
See, I knew he could.
Yeah. Take our military presence in the eastern part of the country, expand it further, and help those who live there build up essentially a democratic alternative to the Assad regime in the West. And then slowly use eastern Syria to encroach on western Syria carefully, because we don't want to do anything that would incite too much of a Russian response. Work with rebels in the West, work with dissidents in the West to undermine the Assad regime from within. This is not easy. This is not quick. It will take time. But it will show that we do still care about the Syrian people. It will show that we do not let this sort of nonsense, this sort of sickening outrage, go unanswered, and that we may not flash a bunch of missiles on you and rip up an airfield that you can repair in a week. We may not, as George W. Bush once eloquently said, spend $10 million to shoot a missile up a camel's butt. But we will make every effort we can to ensure that if you torture and terrorize your people like this, that at the end of the day, you will be gone. No matter how long that day lasts, no matter how much we have to do. I just told you how.
Yeah.
Isn't that essentially our strategy in Korea in the 50s?
We did nothing in Korea in the 50s to support dissidents and rebels in the northern part of Korea. Yeah. We just spent five years
funding the freedom fighters there. They were doctors learning to shoot rifles. It didn't work.
We hardly gave them anything. We gave them 2 or 3 weeks training. We told them they couldn't actually fight Assad. They had to fight ISIS instead. Half of them left for that reason, because Assad was the one they really wanted to fight. ISIS wasn't even in their area. ISIS was largely Iraqi Baathists who were interested in knocking over the elected government in Baghdad. They wanted to fight Bashar Assad because Bashar Assad is truly evil. Bashar Assad has done a wonderful job of convincing everybody that it was him or ISIS. It's not. And the fact of the matter is, we spent far too little effort trying to build a genuine anti-Assad rebel force. neither President Obama nor the Republican Congress that he shared power with, nor Donald Trump or the Republican Congress he shares power with, have genuinely done anything to seriously threaten Bashar Assad's power other than to say, we want him gone, and fold our arms and hope that the Syrian people can do it basically on their own with a few three-week training courses that we throw in. That's not serious.
No, listen, DJ, you know that I respect your point of view and you always have great information. On this one, I just have to disagree with you. I think you're just spinning a tale here. That's not the reality. They did put a lot of assets into those freedom fighters. I remember McCain and Graham going over there and talking with them and then beating up Obama for not doing enough. And then he pumped more money into it. And no, I never heard anybody say that they told them they had to fight ISIS. They were there to fight the Assad regime. And to say that they weren't trying to overthrow Assad is just not, it does not comport with the facts. So DJ, spinning it, but no, it's not the reality I understand.
Well, that's because you're on the West Coast and you don't see what goes on in Washington. We do. We've been here on the East Coast. We've been watching. No, you don't see the things that I see because you don't pay attention to inside baseball.
Is that a short joke?
Because I geek up. No, that's me saying that I have a very unhealthy addiction to politics, and I get into the stuff. I get far too deep into the weeds. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this against a regime this brutal, this sort of thing takes time. It took 13 years to knock over the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan. That regime actually outlasted the Soviet Union. It was so vicious and so terrifying. It took 12 years to end the Marxist terrorist regime in Ethiopia. That took time. That took effort. It took 12 years. I don't know why. Maybe it's a 12-year thing. It took 12 years to knock over the Daniel Ortega Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. You can't just put it on a timeline and go, oh, you ran out of time. You have to put in continuous effort. And the fact that John McCain repeatedly told Barack Obama he wasn't doing enough, and frankly, no one in Congress listened to John McCain either. So I don't want to lay this all at Obama's feet. There are a lot of Republicans in Congress who wanted to do essentially the bare minimum. And that's what was done. It was the bare minimum.
They wouldn't allow him to attack the regime when they had the first gas attack. He went to Congress and asked for authorization to respond to the first gas attack, and they turned him down flat.
Well, some of this was contextual. We were just coming off of Iraq and Afghanistan. There was only so much blood and treasure the American people were willing to put forth in another country, foreign war in another country. Particularly when, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm almost as weedy a political guy as DJ. I don't know how Bashar Assad came to power. I was actually about to ask DJ that. I don't know the history
his
of this
father
conflict
died.
Or why it's our responsibility
his,
to fix it.
His father took power in 1967 and then promptly invaded Israel.
Yeah. 1967 was not a good year. Okay.
No. Then he...
The Six-Day War.
Yeah. I mean, it did not go well for Assad. So he took it out on his own people. When there was an uprising in, I believe it was the city of Hama, he essentially wiped the entire city off the map. It was population 20,000 on Sunday, population zero on Monday. Hafez al-Assad was a well-known supporter of Iran, a well-known supporter of Hezbollah and all the nonsense they did in Beirut. And when he died in 2000, his son Bashar Assad took over, maintained the close ties with Iran and with communist China and with North Korea. He was hoping North Korea would help him become a nuclear power until the Israeli Air Force put paid to that in 2007. There have always been rumors, I don't necessarily believe them, that he allowed Saddam Hussein to hide whatever size weapons of mass destruction program he had and basically stole it from him. Bashar Assad could do that on his could create his own WMD and chemical weapons facilities as he is shown to do. And while the focus has been on the sarin gas attacks of 2013 and 2017, there have been multiple chlorine gas attacks all over rebel-held areas of Syria in 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. But because it was chlorine gas, and because chlorine gas was not included in that ridiculous 2013 chemical weapons agreement, everybody just kind of looked the other way and said, oh, well, that's not a big deal. The simple fact of the matter is the world does not want to care about Syria. But I do. And, well, too fucking bad to the rest of you.
By the way, that's going to be our new catchphrase instead of Real Debate Without the Hate.
Hi,
welcome to the More Perfect Union. Too fucking bad to the rest of you.
The More Perfect Union, Real Debate Without the Hate, now heard on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio.
Well, what I find amusing, because I'm not laughing at your theory, DJ, obviously it's a theory and it may turn out to be correct, or maybe it would turn out to be correct if they followed your prescription for policy. But you're talking about very subtle, nuanced diplomatic concepts. And today was the first day of Dr. Strangelove's appointment to be the National Security Advisor. So I see this going in a slightly different direction.
I would remind you people that this is also the man who was the spearhead for the Proliferation Security Initiative, which is widely considered to be the most successful international arms interdiction program since the Second World War. So let's not, I may be very strange in that, and this may surprise a lot of listeners, but the fact of the matter is,
please.
It's called the Proliferation Security Initiative, PSI. It was created mainly as a way to try to slow down North Korea's nuclear weapons program. In the process, John Bolton became the highest-ranking Bush administration official to actually get France to do what he wanted, because France really kicked in big on the PSI. And while obviously it was not perfect, it was widely credited with dramatically slowing down not only North Korea's development of nuclear weapons, but also any of their attempts to sell their knowledge and their information to the outside world. And it was continued under the Obama administration. I think it's still going on today. And it's been widely touted as a success. That was John Bolton's initiative. That was his baby. So don't just automatically assume that that he's the character from your 1960 nightmare films.
Well, let me just say this. If you consider his program, which I've never heard of before today, to have been a success in slowing down North Korea's nuclear proliferation, I'd hate to see what you consider failure, because they're kind of there right now.
failure was when the Bush administration essentially downgraded it for a 2007 deal with North Korea that made absolutely no fucking sense whatsoever. Oh, crap. We're a rated R podcast now. I'm sorry, Kevin.
I know, we're going to have the little E next
sorry.
It's okay. You know, I'm just relieved that it's not me dropping the first F-bomb. Usually, you know, my son always calls me out if he hears this, "Mom! Why are you cursing?"
So we've got all of these national military and international military hotspots that President Trump has to figure out, you know, the big chess game of international diplomacy and military diplomacy. And yet, where is he sending our military might this week? To the Mexican border. Because clearly, of all the places in the world that needed National Guard to pick up the slack, it was on the border, because a few hundred people from like Guatemala or God knows where were walking.
They're coming from Honduras.
Honduras were walking
north. And they're asylum seekers.
North.
They're planning. They're attempting a legal path to entry into the United States. They weren't planning to jump the border. They were stopping in Mexico to meet with counsel and learn how to apply for asylum, because they were coming from a dangerous situation. They're senior citizens. They're women who faced, you know, assault in their home country. These aren't, you know, gangs from the borderland that are coming to sell meth.
It was just the opposite. It was people that were trying to get away from the gangs. In fact, this was an army of 16-year-old sexual abuse victims at the hands of these people.
Yeah, and it somehow got misrepresented on Fox and Friends, and the president decided we need to send the National Guard. And if I'm a governor in a southwestern state or a western state going into wildfire season, going into tornado season, and the president is asking for members of my National Guard to go be deployed to the border, I'm thinking, okay, well then who's going to, you know, come in and evacuate people during a natural disaster, which is probably imminent just given weather patterns. This seems really short-sighted and a real misuse of National Guard in this particular situation, because there isn't actually an instigating event. There's just this idea that Trump had.
So just to be clear, because this seems to be my job, to pour cold water on everything, both Bush and Obama had called the military down to the border, okay? The guard down.
As I understand it, it was because...
But hold on. I'm going to finish that off, though. But right now, the people who are crossing is at an all-time low, okay, in modern history. And like Rebecca said, it is mostly women. And how it works now is they're usually turning themselves in. And if they turn themselves in, then they have to go to immigration court, which in itself is a wholly terrible thing. But it takes, because of the backlog at immigration court, where they have to go and say, look, I'm seeking asylum. It takes up to 5 years in some places to get a court date.
Immigration court sounds like the dullest reality show one could ever watch. Unless Judge Judy is doing it.
I was going to say, is that what you were writing for before Night Court in the 80s, Kevin? You know, the immigration court, a short-lived series that did not get picked up. But just to go back to the idea that Bush and Obama both sent the National Guard to the border, there were non-enforcement related needs along the border. Like, they needed to actually fix stuff like buildings and barracks and things like that. And they brought in the guard to assist in that part. So they weren't doing actual border enforcement. They were providing other types of support that didn't have to do with actual managing of immigrants. I might be wrong on that. I may have misread the history.
That's how I remember it too. It was basically they did that. They did a lot of back end stuff. They didn't actually do any interface with anyone coming over the border.
Yeah, it was. They weren't going out there to brandish their guns and make Trump feel like a big man.
Well, let's end on something that's kind of uplifting. At least it is to me, and I'm guessing maybe it is for Greg too. The fact that the teachers of Oklahoma are standing up for themselves. They're on strike this week.
It's not just Oklahoma. We've seen strikes in West Virginia. We've seen strikes in Kentucky and Oklahoma. It is our heartfelt that we're finally seeing the teachers trying to say, you know, it's kind of sad that we're seeing what teachers are actually getting paid. Teachers are putting their pay stubs out on the interweb. I don't know if you guys see. Some of them are getting paid. You know, teachers with masters are showing their pay stubs, and it's ridiculously sad how little they're getting. They're showing that they work two or three jobs. I mean, it's sad. We want the best people. We want the best people to be our children's caretakers and our educators, and we want the smartest and the brightest
and the best shots.
Oh, God, Kevin.
and we refuse to pay them what they're worth. You know, they have to have master's degrees in most school districts, and in 20, 30 years, and then they're making nothing. There's this myth that they only work half the days, but then we require so much extra training, and they should, because they have a huge responsibility. And yes, they don't stop after 8 hours. Heck, I'm not a full-time teacher. I only teach part-time, and yet I still probably spend close to 40 hours a week teaching. That's crazy. And I make dirt money.
And here's something that's always struck me as an interesting dissonance. The same people who say, you know, who call it class envy, if you call out the 1%, who comment that the Trumps deserve all the money they have and it's fine to be rich, get mad when teachers want a raise and accuse them of being greedy, of wanting something for not enough labor in return. So it's, you know, okay, what qualifies you to actually want wealth? What do do you have to be allowed to want to be rich? Why aren't teachers allowed to want material comfort? And that's an argument that I've never quite understood, that people, you know, are unwilling to pay teachers as much as they deserve.
Right. We teachers work really hard. They have a great service towards our community, and we trust them with children.
Yes, I mean, I was just thinking that. We entrust them with our children up to the age of 18 and sometimes beyond.
And beyond.
And yet we don't think that they should be paid more than 40 grand a year.
Right. I mean, that's just a... And I'm dating myself because I'm super old. But when I started teaching in 1995, so I'm not, I guess, that old. But I was making... My first year, I think I made... like 24,000, maybe 23,000 a year. And I mean, I owed from college loans alone like 25,000. And I was like, oh. So the first thing I did was I told my parents, hey, I think I'm going to be living on the couch for a little while. Do you mind if I stay here? And that 3 years later, I was still there because I couldn't afford, and that was sad. And I still worked two other jobs. You know, and that was really embarrassing when I worked at a record shop, on holidays.
Oh, that sounds kind of awesome.
It was kind of awesome, but it was embarrassing when your students would come in and they'd say, oh, can you help me find this record or ring this up for me?
Okay. You know? Well, can I add one thing about teachers? And this is something that goes underreported, especially in negotiations about pensions. In many states, not all, but in many states, teachers are part of a public service union, and they are exempted from Social Security payments. The pension is the only retirement account they have. They are not going to receive Social Security benefits at the end of their career. So when politicians start putting teacher pensions on the chopping block, and when they start using them to negotiate and people start saying, oh, teachers are only in it for the pension, that's because in many, they don't have a 401k, they don't have an IRA, they don't even have Social Security coming to them. The pension is what they have. So check your state's regulations before you start complaining about teacher pensions, because oftentimes their contribution to the pension account is higher than your contribution to Social Security in terms of percentages, and that pension is all they have to retire on.
So I don't even know whether we'll have time to get this in, but Greg mentioned, you know, his part-time jobs and working in a record shop, which sounded kind of cool to us.
It was
and I'm
awesome.
Just wondering, I'd like to go around and find out best part-time or you know, substance job you ever had going back to high school. I'm going to start with you. DJ, most fun job you ever had?
That would have to be a lifeguard at the summer swim club.
Wow. And how old were you?
From 15 to 18.
Ever save anyone?
No, thankfully I did not have to do that.
Did you ever pick up any girls?
No.
How good a lifeguard were you? You didn't save anybody, you didn't get a date. I kid.
Rebecca, what about you?
Summers in college, I worked at a local amusement park outside of Rochester, New York called Seabreeze. I ran Midway games.
You were a carny?
I was a carny, but this was a family park, so basically I was making change and you know, handing out stuffed animals. I wasn't, like, creepy.
Hey, Greg, what about you? Any fun jobs other than the record shop?
Oh, my gosh, I've had so many fun jobs. I've worked in many bands, and those have always been great. I worked in a Chinese restaurant. That was awesome. I worked in back in the day, they were called video rental stores. So I've
like
seen
Blockbuster?
Yeah, sort of, except it was owned by Blockbuster. It was called Major Video, and we rented pornography also. So that was awesome. And I've lied about my age in every until I was 18, I lied about my age to get every job I ever got. I worked in a music instrument shop.
Because of the pornography?
Yeah. I was only 17 when I worked there. I sold music instruments.
Was it behind, like, a curtain?
No.
That's what I remember about video shops in the 80s and 90s, that the porn was, like, just behind a curtain.
The best part was it was a folder, and it had only titles, and then it would have a number. And then you would take – the best story we had was some boys.
So you had to go to the counter to ask for the porn folder?
So there was no pictures anywhere. So one day these boys came in and they just turned 18 and they picked up, the title was called The Best in the West. And they thought that would be a great way to usher themselves into manhood. Three boys getting porn. Awesome. So they came back and they were like, they wanted their money back. And we were like, why is your pornography not satisfying? And they're like, there's no women in it. and we looked at the three and we were like, that doesn't seem like a big deal to us. We're cool. Three young men. And they got really pissed off. And I said, no problem. I said, just give it back. I will send this back to your, and it was their dad's card. And I said, I'm just going to send this with the name. And I said, it was called Best in the West, right? Let me write this out. And I showed them the slip I was sending to their house. It said, refund for pornography, Best in the West. And they freaked out and they said, never mind. And they ran. So, yeah.
And Kevin, what about you?
Two jobs that come to mind. One was being a doorman at the Comedy Store, which was obviously fun because I got to watch comics all night. But nice. Surprisingly, one of my favorite jobs I ever had was as a bank teller.
Oh, I did that too.
When I first got out of college, skimming off the top?
I mean, if we're asking these questions.
I was the straightest bank teller. Nobody ever accused me of lifting a dime because they just thought I was so straight and narrow, which I was. But the reason that I loved that job was all day long, all I did was sit there, flirt with cute girls and give people money, and everybody was happy.
That's a pretty great job.
Yeah, it was. And the other thing that I loved about it was, you know, we've all had jobs, whether you're a teacher, whether you're an economist, whether you're a writer, whether, you know, everything that we've ever done, you go home and you stress about it overnight. But when I was a bank teller, never once did I go home and go, oh my God, am I going to be able to make change tomorrow? It's just, there was no stress to that job.
That's how I felt about the amusement park, making the change and handing out the stuff to animals. Like, am I going to be able to hand out this, you know, stuff? Noid from the Domino's commercials. Remember the Noid?
Yeah.
Remember the Domino's Noid? Avoid the Noid?
Well, let me just end by saying there's a reason that I asked about all of these different jobs that we had, because I've heard through the grapevine that Rod Rosenstein is a listener to ours, and he may have to be looking very soon for a new job. So, Rod, there's hope out there. There's a lot of fun things you can still do. We want to thank Rod and everyone else for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at #MPUPodcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. And if you like political debate, you can find us between shows in our political debate group on Facebook. It's called Open Fire Politics. We're all there, and we'd love to see you there, too. So, any predictions on whether Mark Zuckerberg, when he testifies before Congress, will he be wearing an American flag pin or an American flag tie?
I'll go with the pin. He doesn't wear ties.
No. I want him to wear a hoodie, and I want him to do the speech that Jesse Eisenberg did in the Social Network and say, am I giving you my full attention? No, I'm giving you about 10% of my attention, because that's what it's worth. I want him to do that whole thing. Like, this is not worth my full attention. I'm a genius.